On Petawash Day, you are listening to KDKO FM coming to you from Lake Gandy, South Dakota. And you're tuned in to Ohomani Iotaka. I am Donna Hawkes, your host for our reading program. And we are continuing with Water Lily by Ella DeLoria. And let's begin. A pitiful sight they were. All brown and tawny and gray, their drabness almost indistinguishable from the seary prairies over which they crawled. They were wearing the last of the clothing they had brought out with them, long since bedraggled and soiled, ripped and torn. Even the last of the extra pairs of moccasins were now in holes. Their faces were blotched here and there with the marks of their disease, and their hair hung loose and neglected, though that was partly in mourning. Though homeward bound, they were not excited or happy. Already they had learned from the cousin what the state of affairs was at home. Many familiar faces would be missing, for the cruel scourge had touched every family. In good hunters Teoshpai, several had died, including the youngest wife, who was a cousin of the other two, and whose children were still small. Thus only the middle wife was left to Good Hunter, as he would soon know. He himself had come through untouched by the disease. He refused to accept it, and therefore he did not take it. That's what the people were saying. He had gone everywhere unafraid and had laid many a child's body away unaided, thus helping those families whom circumstances had compelled to stay in the camp circle the entire time. Having learned what they would find, the two women were aware that they must weep again when they got home, as if they had not done enough weeping already. Long since wearied to exhaustion, Water Lily thought she could bear no more of it. Weeping, weeping, always weeping. Will a day ever come when I can truly be happy again? She asked herself. She doubted it. It was to a camp circle of ruin and desolation that they returned, and it was deserted. After Echo's cousin had set out to find them, the people, finally suspecting the contagion in their material goods, had burned everything they could do without, including their teepees. Then they had withdrawn to another site in a wide valley nearby, where they were now settled in winter quarters. From the hilltop where the returning party stopped and looked down, they could see nothing at first. Only gradually were they able to delineate little makeshift dwellings set in clusters hugging the timberline. These were of grass or of skins, thrown over dome-shaped frames of willow, and the people living in them had now been reduced to the very lowest poverty. They were, in fact, right back where their ancestors must have been before the advent of the horse. So they must live until spring, if possible. They must endure either cold shelters or smoke from the fires kindled inside to keep them warm. The wind flaps that controlled the draft in a conventional teepee would be sorely missed. But at least they still had their horses. With them, the people could rehabilitate themselves when hunting was possible again, when the sick were well and strong once more, and sorrowful hearts were healed. And then they would be happy as before, and feasts and ceremonies and play and warfare, all of the elements that constituted their life, would be resumed. The industrious and the skillful would soon be well off again. It was always so. But at present, all were leveled very low. Every family was forlorn. With Sacred Horse gone, Water Lily felt that she could not stay on with her relatives of marriage. The link that held her to them was broken. Kind as they were, she suddenly felt herself a complete stranger in their midst. They said to her, His going makes no difference. You belong here. She did not think so. Though she did not, of course, contradict them, for she still had a respect attitude to remain. When her parents came for her, she would go home, for that was where she really belonged. Home. The very word thrilled her. But already it was beginning to snow. Not serious snowstorms, but an occasional flake, for example. Soon they must be winterbound, and then she would be trapped here inside a small shelter with only formal relatives, and she would have to be self-contained and restrained. In such a confine, how could she sustain that manner until spring? For she knew well enough that her parents could not possibly arrive before then. But the next best thing happened to her in a few days. Her social father and mother claimed her. "Come home, daughter," they said. "No wife needs to stay on where there is no longer a husband to draw her. You shall live with us, poor as our lodge is. At least it is no worse than anyone else's. And it shall be your home until your people come for you." Here was comfort beyond words. This was what auxiliary parents were for, to step in and take over in place of one's own parents in their absence, to reach out and extricate one and surround one with home-like tenderness. How all-sufficient kinship was! Water Lily felt that with these social parents she could endure anything. Their shelter was, if anything, even smaller than that of Good Hunter, and would certainly be just as cold and smoky, but it was occupied only by the parents and the brother, Red Leaf, and herself. The atmosphere was one that allowed freedom from kinship taboos. She could stand the winter here. It was entirely proper for Water Lily to go with those she called father and mother, since her husband was dead. The family of Good Hunter knew this and did not try to hold her. Yet, because she went, they did not therefore sever their ties with her. Their sense of responsibility for her remained, increased, in fact, for there was a child on the way, and it claimed solicitous interest in its mother. Particularly was this interest felt by the male collateral relatives of the dead Sacred Horse, his brothers and cousins. Already they had conferred in secret about Water Lily, and when that cousin who had brought them back from the wilds took leave of her, he said, "May I see you in health some day, wife of my cousin?" Then he added, "I have something I must say to you before we part. We in our group do not neglect our own. You are ours, wherever you go." A delicate reference to the child she carried, who would soon be son or daughter to its father's brothers and male cousins. Most of us already have our wives and families, and none of us is in a position to take a second wife, being still not of that age and prestige when such a step is suitable. Then he paid her a compliment. "Nor would we consider your being anything less than first wife to any man." Water Lily told him she had no thought of remarrying, but the man continued, "Do not vow that. You are just a girl. Your life is only beginning. You will marry again, and that is right. Back home, I have a young brother who is still alone. He is the likely one for you. If perchance he pleased you for a husband, it would be well for the coming child's sake. Whenever possible, a child should have for father one who is father to him already, and not a total unrelated stranger. For the child, then, I entreat you to stay as you are. Young as you are, keep steady, being not overly hasty to remarry, but wait for my brother, whom I shall send to you." He spoke earnestly. "Wait for Luana." Water Lily might have known. Once when Sacred Horse was telling her about his relatives in other camp circles and had spoken of his brothers and cousins, he had referred to one who was a very fine singer and who had entered the Sundance at an early age. But he had neglected to name the cousin, and Water Lily could not bring herself to ask, even casually, "What is his name?" for fear it might appear as though she were interested in other men. She had blushed to remember how once she had been carried away by a charming stranger who was also a singer and a very youthful sun dancer, so much that she had taken water to him secretly. "But that was long ago, when I was very young," she told herself, though she knew that only 4 winters had since passed. Out of loyalty to her husband and a willed indifference to that once charming singer, whose appearance had become but a blur in her mind, she had had no difficulty in shedding the whole matter. And now here he was, turning up again. She was sure it was the same man, as a candidate for her next husband, without his knowledge. Ordinarily, it would have been an exciting prospect. Overwhelmed by tragedy, a confused and homesick young widow with child, Water Lily heard the cousin's proposal and even the name Lonwala with complete passivity. She simply thanked the cousin of her dead husband for his concern and turned away. The long winter in the cold, semi-dark hut was conducive to nothing but waiting with idle hands. Water Lily could not see to make anything beautiful for her coming baby, and she fretted under the enforced waste of time. And so much she wanted to do. Under such adverse circumstances, it was impossible not to be homesick. But she must not let her kind parents see, lest it seem ungrateful of her. The concealing of her homesickness thus became a preoccupation, and she thought she was successful at giving an appearance of complete contentment. Therefore, it came as a surprise when one day her mother returned from another hut down the timberline and said to her, "There, daughter, it is all fixed."
"What is fixed, mother?"
"That you shall go home. Yes, right now, even though it is winter. A winter trip for you toward a place for which you yearn is better than safety here, where you try in vain to be happy." She had guessed it. "You could become sick doing that. But now your father has found a way for us to take you home." Then she explained. A war party was starting out toward the Blackfeet country, far off to the northwest. When Water Lily's social father had heard of this, he had enlisted the warrior's protection on the way as far as the camp circle of White Ghost, which would be only a little east of their route. They had agreed to travel slowly that far to escort the young widow to her home. But the neighbors advised vehemently against the trip. They came in with stories of how so-and-so was snowed under for many days and was almost suffocated until he worked his way out, and of how a woman had once died in a blizzard and was found in the spring, having perished in the act of giving birth. "Do not expose this young girl to that risk," they begged. "She has already been through too much." And they pointed out that this, the moon of raccoons, February, and the sore eyes moon to follow were always marked with the trickiest of weather. "Why, out of nowhere, a blizzard can come up, catching people unaware," they warned. The parents were disturbed by these stories, but once the way was indicated to her, Water Lily was determined to go home, come what may. The women rode separate horses and followed certain of the warriors who were assigned to vanguard duty. The others, including the social father, kept on either side of them and in the rear, much as they did when a camp circle was moving.
Take plenty of robes, the war chief had advised. Then, if we should run into a storm, we can set up willow poles anywhere and piece a tent out of the robes. As had been predicted, there was a big blizzard on the way, forcing them to stop. They hurriedly improvised a teepee in the lee of a high cliff, and there they stayed for 2 days, waiting for the storm to spend itself. From long practice, the warriors quickly arranged everything and prepared the food, which they served to the women. While they waited there, some strange people came in one evening. A surprise, because it was far from any human habitation. There was a man and his wife, both well over 50, two girls, their daughters, and three small children. One of the daughters was with child. As if she were their mother, the little ones kept close to the man's wife, a stupid-looking woman who said not a word more than was necessary. Only the man talked, plausibly enough, accounting for their unexpected presence out there. But he was plainly evading the truth. After they had gone, the warriors agreed that the man was probably a degenerate character who lived away from civilization, that is to say, the camp circle, because of some crime against society. It was impossible that his wife, at her age, could be the mother of those small children. And since the man was the only male, the conclusion was inescapable. Oh, something very bad, was the way the warriors voiced their suspicion, carefully avoiding the ugly equivalent of incest. It is unspeakable, the war chief went on. No wonder that those who offend so heinously against kinship do not have the courage to mingle with decent folk, preferring to hide out where their other beasts are. He would not have ventured here, but hunger drove him in. But while the visitors were there, the warriors nevertheless extended hospitality to them and, out of human decency, sent them away with quantities of jerked meat and other foods. They included the man in their conversation, even handing him the pipe. They must do this for their own reputation as hosts. The rule said, in effect, treat as a man any stranger in your teepee who bears the physical semblance of a man. What sort the man might be was not the determining factor for extending such courtesies. Both man and wife seemed to be hiding something, never once looking candidly at anyone. It was, of course, customary to avert your gaze when speaking to one of the opposite sex. That was a matter of decorum. But here was a man of shifting eye, who could not look straight at other men without flinching, and a woman who avoided the eyes of women. Something was surely amiss. As for the daughters, they had no manners at all. Looking boldly into the warriors' faces and grinning foolishly, they sat down cross-legged in the manner of men, but soon they were devouring the food offered them, forgetful of their surroundings in their eagerness to eat. When finished, they whispered together a while and then went stumbling out the entrance without one word of thanks for the food and without returning their bowls to the hostess. They were quite incredible. It was the little ones, however, who excited Water Lily's real pity. When there was an awkward silence, after she and her social mother had tried in vain to chat with the woman, she turned to the children. With a smile, she reached out a friendly hand to them and was shocked by their sudden reaction. Altogether, they shrank back and began wrinkling up their noses belligerently at her with a lightning rapidity and a precision that made it comical. Then they settled back against their mother, who made no show of correcting their unfriendly actions. And next, from the folds of her wrap, they stuck out their tongues repeatedly while Water Lily gazed at them in amazement. Instantaneously, they had turned into wild cubs, ready momentarily to resist being picked up and carried away. After such a complete rebuff, Water Lily sat listening to the men's talk and forgot the strange children for a time. Much later, when accidentally, she again looked their way, there they were, all quietly staring at her with fear and hostility in their shining black eyes, which never wavered once, lest she make another attack and they be caught off guard. Friendship had been omitted from their experience, along with everything else that makes life warm and pleasant. Here were unbelievably wild, untutored children. No one had ever said to them, "No, don't do that. See? Nobody does so." And thereby shamed them into good behavior towards those about them. There were no others about them from whom they might learn by imitation. And so they were growing up without civility, and the results were terrifying to see. Camp Circle people were civilized. They knew how to treat one another. They had rules. These children were wild because they lacked any standards of social behavior. It came over Water Lily as she observed the unfortunate children, so unkempt and so hostile, how very much people needed human companions. It was the only way to learn how to be human. People were at once a check and spur to one another. Everyone needed others for comparison, for a standard for himself. This measuring and evaluating of self was only possible in Camp Circle life, where everyone was obliged to be constantly aware of those about him, to address himself to them in approved ways. Thus only did people learn to be responsible for each other and themselves. Water Lily used to think that critics and gossips were a public nuisance. But now, seeing these wild people with nobody to criticize them, she decided that perhaps they were an actual necessity, that maybe they could not be spared. If it were not for the critics, people could never know whether they were being at their best or their worst. Here were people unquestionably at their worst, and they did not know it. They did not know enough to care how they must appear to the party they had evaded. They were unconscious of being judged by them. It was a tragic thing to stay alone like this in a benighted state. It was better to stay with other people and try to do your best according to the rules there. Water Lily, of course, did not say this in so many words to herself. Nevertheless, it was what she sensed keenly as she sat watching the children. Late that night, the storm abated and the moon broke through, shining with a diffused light through the air still dense with flying particles of snow. It gave an unearthly quality to the scene. The weather judge stood outside. "By morning, it will be possible to start out. We must avoid the ravines, which will be packed with snow, and keep along the ridges where it is windswept, for then we can travel right along," he said. He was right. The morning was clear and crisp, sunny and cold. The sky was a blue of the deepest intensity, and as far as the eye could see, frosted snow glinted like stars on trees, bushes, shrubs, and rocks, and over the mantled prairies. Everything was pure white, except for a dark patch here and there in the shallow dips of the land, where tall stalks of yellow grass stiffly perforated the crust. It was a perfect winter day, and the party traveled contentedly. All along, it seemed to Water Lily, The only sounds were the crunch, crunch, crunch of breaking crust and the rhythmic squeak of soft snow underneath with every step of her horse. So they continued for 3 more days before they found White Ghost's winter quarters. The war party escorted Water Lily and her social parents directly to Rainbow's teepee. After they were well feasted, they went on. Water Lily's social parents were invited to remain as guests until spring, and they could accept in good conscience, knowing that Red Leaf was safe in the care of his uncle and aunt and other relatives back home. Okay, we're going to end there today, and we'll be back again next week with more of Water Lily by Ella Deloria. So I want to say, Pidamia, thank you for joining me this week. And Doksha Ake, we will meet again next week, continuing with our story. And you are listening to Ohomani Iyotaka. Gather in a circle and sit down. It's storytelling time. And I am your host, Donna Hawkins. You are listening to KDKO Radio from Lake Andy, South Dakota. Funding for this program was provided by the Corporation of Public Broadcasting.